This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity by Catherine Bu, read for you by Sunil Malhotra. Prologue, Between Roses. July 17, 2008, Mumbai. Midnight was closing in. The one-legged woman was grievously burned, and the Mumbai police were coming for Abdul and his father. In a slum hut by the international airport, Abdul's parents came to a decision with an uncharacteristic economy of words. The father, a sick man, would wait inside the trash-strewn, tin-roofed shack where the family of 11 resided. He'd go quietly when arrested. Abdul, the household earner, was the one who had to flee. Abdul's opinion of this plan had not been solicited, typically. Already he was mule-brained with panic. He was 16 years old, or maybe 19. His parents were hopeless with dates. Allah, in his impenetrable wisdom, had cut him small and jumpy. A coward, Abdul said it of himself. He knew nothing about eluding policemen. What he knew about, mainly, was trash. For nearly all the waking hours of nearly all the years he could remember, he'd been buying and selling to recyclers the things that richer people threw away. Now Abdul grasped the need to disappear, but beyond that, his imagination flagged. He took off running, then came back home. The only place he could think to hide was in his garbage. He cracked the door of the family hut and looked out. His home sat midway down a row of hand-built, spatchcock dwellings. The lopsided shed where he stowed his trash was just next door. To reach this shed unseen would deprive his neighbors of the pleasure of turning him into the police. He didn't like the moon, though, full and stupid bright, illuminating a dusty open lot in front of his home. Across the lot were the shacks of 24 other families, and Abdul feared he wasn't the only person peering out from behind the cover of a plywood door. Some people in this slum wished his family ill because of the old Hindu-Muslim resentments. Others resented his family for the modern reason, economic envy. Doing waste work that many Indians found contemptible, Abdul had lifted his large family above subsistence. The open lot was quiet, at least, freakishly so. A kind of beachfront for a vast pool of sewage that marked the slum's eastern border, the place was bedlam most nights. People fighting, cooking, flirting, bathing, tending goats, playing cricket, waiting for water at a public tap, lining up outside a little brothel, or sleeping off the effects of the grave-digging liquor dispensed from a hut 2 doors down from Abdul's own. The pressures that built up in crowded huts on narrow slum lanes had only this place, the Maidan, to escape. But after the fight, and the burning of the woman called the One Leg, people had retreated to their huts. Now, among the feral pigs, water buffalo, and the usual belly-down splay of alcoholics, there seemed to be just one watchful presence, a small, unspookable boy from Nepal. He was sitting, arms around knees, in a spangly blue haze by the sewage lake, the reflected neon signage of a luxury hotel across the water. Abdul didn't mind if the Nepali boy saw him go into hiding. This kid, Adarsh, was no spy for the police. He just liked to stay out late to avoid his mother and her nightly rages. It was as safe a moment as Abdul was going to get. He bolted for the trash shed and closed the door behind him. Inside was carbon black, frantic with rats, and yet relieving. His storeroom. 120 square feet, piled high to a leaky roof with the things in this world Abdul knew how to handle. Empty water and whiskey bottles, mildewed newspapers, used tampon applicators, wadded aluminum foil, umbrellas stripped to the ribs by monsoons, broken shoelaces, yellowed Q-tips, snarled cassette tape, torn plastic casings that once held imitation Barbies. Somewhere in the darkness, there was a Barbie or Barbly itself, maimed in one of the experiments to which children who had many toys seemed to subject those toys no longer favored. Abdul had become expert, over the years, at minimizing distraction. He placed all such dolls in his trash pile, tits down. Avoid trouble. This was the operating principle of Abdul Hakim Hussein, an idea so fiercely held that it seemed imprinted on his physical form. He had deep-set eyes and sunken cheeks, a body work-hunched and wiry, the type that claimed less than its fair share of space when threading through people-choked slum lanes. Almost everything about him was recessed, save the pop-out ears and the hair that curled upward, girlish, whenever he wiped his forehead of sweat. A modest, missable presence was a useful thing in Anawadi, the sumpy plug of slum in which he lived. Here, in the thriving western suburbs of the Indian financial capital, 3,000 people had packed into, or on top of, 335 huts. It was a continual coming and going of migrants from all over India, Hindus mainly, from all manner of castes and subcastes. His neighbors represented beliefs and cultures so various that Abdul, one of the slum's 36 Muslims, could not begin to understand them. He simply recognized Anawadi as a place booby-trapped with contentions, new and ancient, over which he was determined not to trip. For Anawadi was also magnificently positioned for a trafficker in rich people's garbage. Abdul and his neighbors were squatting on land that belonged to the Airports Authority of India. Only a coconut tree-lined thoroughfare separated the slum from the entrance to the international terminal. Serving the airport clientele and encircling Anawadi were 5 extravagant hotels, 4 ornate, marbly megaliths and 1 sleek blue-glass Hyatt, from the top-floor windows of which Anawadi and several adjacent squatter settlements looked like villages that had been airdropped into gaps between elegant modernities. "Everything around us is roses," is how Abdul's younger brother, Mirchi, put it, "and we're the shit in between." In the new century, as India's economy grew faster than any other but China's, pink condominiums and glass office towers had shot up near the international airport. One corporate office was named, simply, More. More cranes for making more buildings, the tallest of which interfered with the landing of more and more planes. It was a smogged-out, prosperity-driven obstacle course up there in the overcity, from which wads of possibility had tumbled down to the slums. Every morning, thousands of waste pickers fanned out across the airport area in search of vendable excess, a few pounds of the 8,000 tons of garbage that Mumbai was extruding daily. These scavengers darted after crumpled cigarette packs tossed from cars with tinted windows. They dredged sewers and raided dumpsters for empty bottles of water and beer. Each evening, they returned down the slum road with gunny sacks of garbage on their backs, like a procession of broken-toothed, profit-minded Santas. Abdul would be waiting at his rusty scale. In the hierarchy of the undercity's waste business, the teenager was a notch above the scavengers, a trader who appraised and bought what they found. His profit came from selling the refuse in bulk to small recycling plants a few miles away. Abdul's mother was the haggler in the family, raining vibrant abuse upon scavengers who asked too much for their trash. For Abdul, words came stiff and slow. Where he excelled was in the sorting, the crucial, exacting process of categorizing the purchased waste into one of 60 kinds of paper, plastic, metal, and the like, in order to sell it. Of course he would be fast. He'd been sorting since he was about 6 years old because tuberculosis and garbage work had wrecked his father's lungs. Abdul's motor skills had developed around his labor.
"You didn't have the mind for school anyway," his father had recently observed.
Abdul wasn't sure he'd had enough schooling to make a judgment either way. In the early years, he'd sat in a classroom where nothing much happened. Then there had been only work. Work that churned so much filth into the air it turned his snot black. Work more boring than dirty. Work he expected to be doing for the rest of his life. Most days, that prospect weighed on him like a sentence. Tonight, hiding from the police, it felt like a hope. The smell of the one leg's burning was fainter in the shed, given the competing stink of trash and the fear sweat that befouled Abdul's clothing. He stripped, hiding his pants and shirt behind a brittle stack of newspapers near the door. His best idea was to climb to the top of his 8-foot tangle of garbage, then burrow in against the back wall as far as possible from the door. He was agile and in daylight could scale this keenly balanced mound in 15 seconds. But a misstep in the dark would cause a landslide of bottles and cans, which would broadcast his whereabouts widely, since the walls between huts were thin and shared. To Abdul's right, disconcertingly, came quiet snores. A laconic cousin newly arrived from a rural village who probably assumed that women burned in the city every day. Moving left, Abdul felt around the blackness for a mass of blue polyurethane bags. Dirt magnets, those bags. He hated sorting them. But he recalled tossing the bundled bags onto a pile of soggy cardboard, the stuff of a silent climb. He found the bags and boxes by the side wall, the one that divided his shed from his home. Hoisting himself up, he waited. The cardboard compressed. The rats made rearrangements, but nothing metal clattered to the floor. Now he could use the side wall for balance as he considered his next step. Someone was shuffling on the other side of the wall. His father, most likely. He'd be out of his nightclothes now, wearing the polyester shirt that hung loose on his shoulders, probably studying a palmful of tobacco. The man had been playing with his tobacco all evening, fingering it into circles, triangles, circles again. It was what he did when he didn't know what he was doing. A few more steps, some unhelpful clanking, and Abdul had gained the back wall. He lay down. Now he regretted not having his pants. Mosquitoes, the edges of torn clamshell packaging slicing into the backs of his thighs. The burn smell lingering in the air was bitter, more kerosene and melted sandal than flesh. Had Abdul happened across it in one of the slum lanes, he wouldn't have doubled over. It was orange blossoms compared with the rotting hotel food dumped nightly at Anawadi, which sustained 300 shit-caked pigs. The problem in his stomach came from knowing what and who the smell was. Abdul had known the one leg since the day, 8 years back, that his family had arrived in Anawadi. He'd had no choice but to know her, since only a sheet had divided her shack from his own. Even then, her smell had troubled him. Despite her poverty, she perfumed herself somehow. Abdul's mother, who smelled of breast milk and fried onions, disapproved. In the sheet days, as now, Abdul believed his mother, Zerunisa, to be right about most things. She was tender and playful with her children, and her only great flaw, in the opinion of Abdul, her eldest son, was the language she used when haggling. Although profane bargaining was the norm in the waste business, he felt his mother acceded to that norm with too much relish.
"Stupid pimp with the brain of a lemon,"
she'd say in mock outrage.
"You think my babies will go hungry without your cans? I ought to take down your pants and slice off what little is inside."
This from a woman who'd been raised in some nowhere of a village to be burqa-clad devout. Abdul considered himself old-fashioned, 90%, and censured his mother freely.
"And what would your father say to hear you cursing in the street?"
"He would say the worst," Zerunisa replied one day.
"But he was the one who sent me off to marry a sick man. Had I sat quietly in the house the way my mother did, all these children would have starved."
Abdul didn't dare voice the great flaw of his father, Karam Hussein. Too sick to sort much garbage, not sick enough to stay off his wife. The Wahhabi sect in which he'd been raised opposed birth control, and of Zerunisa's 10 births, 9 children had survived. Zerunisa consoled herself, each pregnancy, that she was producing a workforce for the future. Abdul was the workforce of the present, though, and new brothers and sisters increased his anxiety. He made errors, paid scavengers dearly for sacks of worthless things.
"Slow down," his father had told him gently. "Use your nose, mouth, and ears, not just your scales."
Tap the metal scrape with a nail. Its ring will tell you what it's made of. Chew the plastic to identify its grade. If it's hard plastic, snap it in half and inhale. A fresh smell indicates good quality polyurethane. Abdul had learned. One year, there was enough to eat. Another year, there was more of a home to live in. The sheet was replaced by a divider made of scraps of aluminum and, later, a wall of reject bricks, which established his home as the sturdiest dwelling in the row. The feelings that washed over him when he considered the brick divider were several. Pride. Fear that the quality of the bricks was so poor the wall would crumble. Sensory relief. There was now a 3-inch barrier between him and the one leg, who took lovers while her husband was sorting garbage elsewhere. In recent months, Abdul had had occasion to register her only when she clinked past on her metal crutches, heading for the market or the public toilet. The one leg's crutches seemed to be too short, because when she walked, her butt stuck out, did some switchy thing that made people laugh. The lipstick provided further hilarity. She draws on that face just to squat at the shithole? Some days the lips were orange, other days purple-red, as if she'd climbed the jamun fruit tree by the Hotel Leela and mouthed it clean. The one leg's given name was Sita. She had fair skin, usually an asset, but the runt leg had smacked down her bride price. Her Hindu parents had taken the single offer they got. Poor, unattractive, hard-working, Muslim, old.
Half dead, but who else wanted her?
As her mother had once said with a frown. The unlikely husband renamed her Fatima, and from this mismating had come 3 scrawny girls. The sickliest daughter had drowned in a bucket at home. Fatima did not seem to grieve, which got people talking. After a few days, she re-emerged from her hut, still switchy-hipped and staring at men with her gold-flecked, unlowering eyes. There was too much wanting at Anawadi lately, or so it seemed to Abdul. As India began to prosper, old ideas about accepting the life assigned by one's caste or one's divinities were yielding to a belief in earthly reinvention. Anawadians now spoke of better lives casually, as if fortune were a cousin arriving on Sunday, as if the future would look nothing like the past. Abdul's brother, Mirchi, did not intend to sort garbage. He envisioned wearing a starched uniform and reporting to work at a luxury hotel. He'd heard of waiters who spent all day putting toothpicks into pieces of cheese or aligning knives and forks on tables. He wanted a clean job like that.
"Watch me," he once snapped at their mother. "I'll have a bathroom as big as this hut."
The dream of Raja Kamble, a sickly toilet cleaner who lived on the lane behind Abdul's, was of medical rebirth. A new valve to fix his heart, and he'd survive to finish raising his children. 15-year-old Mina, whose hut was around the corner, craved a taste of the freedom and adventure she'd seen on TV serials, instead of an arranged marriage and domestic submission. Sunil, an undersized 12-year-old scavenger, wanted to eat enough to start growing. Asha, a fighter cock of a woman who lived by the public toilet, was differently ambitious. She longed to be Anawadi's first female slumlord, then ride the city's inexorable corruption into the middle class. Her disapproving teenage daughter, Manju, considered her own aim more noble, to become Anawadi's first female college graduate. The most preposterous of these dreamers was the one leg. Everyone thought so. Her abiding interest was in extramarital sex, though not for pocket change alone. That, her neighbors would have understood. But the one leg also wanted to transcend the affliction by which others had named her. She wanted to be respected and reckoned attractive. Anawadians considered such desires inappropriate for a cripple. What Abdul wanted was this. A wife. Innocent of words like pimp and sister fucker, who didn't much mind how he smelled, and eventually a home somewhere, anywhere, that was not Anawadi. Like most people in the slum, and in the world for that matter, He believed his own dreams properly aligned to his capacities. The police were in Anawadi, coming across the Maidan toward his home. It had to be the police. No slum dweller spoke as confidently as this. Abdul's family knew many of the officers at the local station, just enough to fear them all. When they learned that a family in the slum was making money, they visited every other day to extort some. The worst of the lot had been Constable Power, who had brutalized little Deepa, a homeless girl who sold flowers by the Hyatt. But most of them would gladly blow their noses in your last piece of bread. Abdul had been bracing for this moment when the officers crossed his family's threshold, for the sounds of small children screaming, of steel vessels violently upended. But the two officers were perfectly calm, even friendly, as they relayed the salient facts. The one leg had survived and had made an accusation from her hospital bed, that Abdul, his older sister, and their father had beaten her and set her on fire. Later, Abdul would recall the officer's words penetrating the storeroom wall with a fever dream slowness. So his sister, Kekashin, was being accused too. For this, he wished the one leg dead. Then he wished he hadn't wished it. If the one leg died, his family would be even more screwed. To be poor in Anawadi, or in any Mumbai slum, was to be guilty of one thing or another. Abdul sometimes bought pieces of metal that scavengers had stolen. He ran a business, such as it was, without a license. Simply living in Anawadi was illegal, since the airport authority wanted squatters like himself off its land. But he and his family had not burned the one leg. She had set herself on fire. Abdul's father was professing the family's innocence in his breathy, weak-lunged voice as the officers led him out of the house.
"So where is your son?"
one of them demanded loudly as they stood outside the storeroom door. The officer's volume was not, in this instance, a show of power. He was trying to be heard over Abdul's mother, wailing. Zerunisa Hussein was a tear factory, even on good days. It was one of her chief ways of starting conversations. But now her children sobbing intensified her own. The little Husseins' love for their father was simpler than Abdul's love for him, and they would remember the night the police came to take him away. Time passed. Wails subsided.
"He'll be back in half an hour,"
his mother was telling the children in a high-pitched sing-song, one of her lying tones. Abdul took heart in the words, "be back." After arresting his father, the police had apparently left Anawadi. Abdul couldn't rule out the possibility that the officers would return to search for him. But from what he knew of the energy levels of Mumbai policemen, it was more likely that they would call it a night. That gave him 3 or 4 more hours of darkness in which to plan an escape more sensible than a skulk to the hut next door. He didn't feel incapable of daring. One of his private vanities was that all the garbage sorting had endowed his hands with killing strength, that he could chop a brick in half like Bruce Lee.
"So, let's get a brick,"
replied a girl with whom he had once injudiciously shared this conviction. Abdul had bumbled away. The brick belief was something he wanted to harbor, not to test. His brother, Mirchi, 2 years younger, was braver by a stretch and wouldn't have hidden in the storeroom. Mirchi liked the Bollywood movies in which bare-chested outlaws jumped out of high windows and ran across the roofs of moving trains while the policemen in pursuit fired and failed to hit their marks. Abdul took all dangers, in all films, over seriously. He was still living down the night he'd accompanied another boy to a shed a mile away where pirated videos played. The movie had been about a mansion with a monster in its basement, an orange-furred creature that fed on human flesh. When it ended, he'd had to pay the proprietor 20 rupees to let him sleep on the floor because his legs were too stiff with fear to walk home. As ashamed as he felt when other boys witnessed his fearfulness, Abdul thought it irrational to be anything else. While sorting newspapers or cans, tasks that were a matter more of touch than sight, he studied his neighbors instead. The habit killed time and gave him theories. one of which came to prevail over the others. It seemed to him that in Annawadi, fortunes derived not just from what people did or how well they did it, but from the accidents and catastrophes they dodged. A decent life was the train that hadn't hit you, the slumlord you hadn't offended, the malaria you hadn't caught. And while he regretted not being smarter, he believed he had a quality nearly as valuable for the circumstances in which he lived. He was chokanna, alert. "My eyes can see in all directions," was another way he put it. He believed he could anticipate calamity while there was still time to get out of the way. The one leg's burning was the first time he'd been blindsided. What time was it? A neighbor named Cynthia was in the Maidan, shouting,
"Why haven't the police arrested the rest of this family?"
Cynthia was close to Fatima, the one leg, and had despised Abdul's family ever since her own family garbage business failed.
"Let's march on the police station, make the officers come and take them," she called out to the other residents.
From inside Abdul's home came only silence. After a while, mercifully, Cynthia shut up. There didn't seem to be a groundswell of public support for the protest march, just irritation at Cynthia for waking everyone up. Abdul felt the night's tension finally thinning, until steel pots began banging all around him. Startling up, he was confused. Golden light was seeping through the cracks in a door. Not the door of his storeroom. A door it took a minute to place. Pants back on, he seemed to be on the floor of the hut of a young Muslim cook who lived across the Maidan. It was morning. The clangor around him was Annawadians in adjacent huts, making breakfast. When and why had he crossed the Maidan to this hut? Panic had ripped a hole in his memory, and Abdul would never be certain of the final hours of this night. The only clear thing was that in the gravest situation of his life, a moment demanding courage and enterprise, he had stayed in Annawadi and fallen asleep. At once, he knew his course of action. To find his mother. Having proved himself useless as a fugitive, he needed her to tell him what to do.
"Go fast," said Zerunisa Hussein upon issuing her instructions. "Fast as you can."
Abdul grabbed a fresh shirt and flew. Across the clearing, down a zigzag lane of huts, out onto a rubbled road. Garbage and water buffalo, slumside, glimmer glass Hyatt on the other. Fumbling with shirt buttons as he ran. After 200 yards he gained a wide thoroughfare that led to the airport, which was bordered by blooming gardens, pretties of a city he barely knew. Butterflies, even. He blew past them and hooked into the airport. Arrivals down, departures up. He went a third way, running beside a long stretch of blue and white aluminum fencing, behind which jackhammers blasted, excavating the foundations of a glamorous new terminal. Abdul had occasionally tried to monetize the terminal's security perimeter. 2 aluminum panels swiped and sold, and a garbage boy could rest for a year. He kept moving, made a hard right at a field of black and yellow taxis gleaming in a violent morning sun. Another right into a shady curve of driveway, a leafy bough hanging low across it. One more right, and he was inside the Sahar police station. Zerunisa had read her son's face. This boy was too anxious to hide from the police. Her own fear, upon waking, was that the officers would beat her husband as punishment for Abdul's escape. It was the eldest son's duty to protect a sick father from that. Abdul would do his duty, and almost, almost gladly. Hiding was what guilty people did. Being innocent, he wanted the facts stamped on his forehead. So what else to do but submit himself to the stamping authorities, to the law, to justice, concepts in which his limited history had given him no cause to believe? He would try to believe in them now. A police officer in epauletted khaki was splodged behind a gray metal desk. Seeing Abdul, he rose up, surprised. His lips, under his mustache, were fat and fish-like, and Abdul would remember them later, the way they parted a little before he smiled. Part 1. Under Citizens.
Everybody in Anawadi talks like this. Oh, I will make my child a doctor, a lawyer, and he will make us rich. It's vanity, nothing more. Your little boat goes west and you congratulate yourself. What a navigator I am. And then the wind blows you east.
Abdul's father, Karam Hussein. Chapter 1. Anawadi. Let it keep. The moment when Officer Fishlips met Abdul in the police station. Rewind. See Abdul running backward, away from the station and the airport, toward home. See the flames engulfing a disabled woman in a pink-flowered tunic, shrink to nothing but a matchbook on the floor. See Fatima, minutes earlier, dancing on crutches to a raucous love song, her delicate features unscathed. Keep rewinding, back 7 more months, and stop at an ordinary day in January 2008. It was about as hopeful a season as there ever had been in the years since a bitty slum popped up in the biggest city of a country that holds one-third of the planet's poor. A country dizzy now with development and circulating money. Dawn came gusty, as it often did in January, the month of treed kites and head colds. Because his family lacked the floor space for all of its members to lie down, Abdul was asleep on the gritty Maidan, which for years had passed as his bed. His mother stepped carefully over one of his younger brothers, and then another, bending low to Abdul's ear.
"Wake up, fool," she said exuberantly. "You think your work is dreaming?"
Superstitious, Zerunisa had noticed that some of the family's most profitable days occurred after she had showered abuses on her eldest son. January's income being pivotal to the Hussein's latest plan of escape from Anawadi, she had decided to make the curses routine. Abdul rose with minimal whining, since the only whining his mother tolerated was her own. Besides, this was the gentle-going hour in which he hated Anawadi least. The pale sun lent the sewage lake a sparkling silver cast, and the parrots nesting at the far side of the lake could still be heard over the jets. Outside his neighbors' huts, some held together by duct tape and rope, damp rags were discreetly freshening bodies. Children in school uniform neckties were hauling pots of water from the public taps. A languid line extended from an orange concrete block of public toilets. Even goat's eyes were heavy with sleep. It was the moment of the intimate and the familial, before the great pursuit of the tiny market niche got underway. One by one, construction workers departed for a crowded intersection where site supervisors chose day laborers. Young girls began threading marigolds into garlands to be hawked in airport road traffic. Older women sewed patches onto pink and blue cotton quilts for a company that paid by the piece. In a small, sweltering plastic molding factory, bare-chested men cranked gears that would turn colored beads into ornaments to be hung from rear-view mirrors, smiling ducks and pink cats with jewels around their necks that they couldn't imagine anyone anywhere buying. And Abdul crouched on the Maidan, beginning to sort 2 weeks' worth of purchased trash, a stained shirt hitching up his knobby spine. His general approach toward his neighbors was this: "The better I know you, the more I dislike you, and the more you will dislike me. So let us keep to ourselves." But deep in his own work, as he would be this morning, he could imagine his fellow Anawadians laboring companionably alongside him. Anawadi sat 200 yards off the Sahar Airport Road, a stretch where New India collided with Old India and made New India late. Chauffeurs and SUVs honked furiously at the bicycle delivery boys peeling off from a slum chicken shop, each carrying a rack of 300 eggs. Anawadi itself was nothing special in the context of the slums of Mumbai. Every house was off-kilter, so less off-kilter looked like straight. Sewage and sickness looked like life. The slum had been settled in 1991 by a band of laborers trucked in from the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu to repair a runway at the international airport. The work complete, They decided to stay near the airport and its tantalizing construction possibilities. In an area with little unclaimed space, a sodden, snake-filled bit of brushland across the street from the international terminal seemed the least bad place to live. Other poor people consider the spot too wet to be habitable, but the Tamils set to work, hacking down the brush that harbored the snakes, digging up the dirt in drier places, and packing it into the mud. After a month, their bamboo poles stopped flopping over when they were stuck in the ground. Draping empty cement sacks over the poles for cover, they had a settlement. Residents of neighboring slums provided its name, Annawadi, the land of Annas, a respectful Tamil word for older brothers. Less respectful terms for Tamil migrants were in wider currency, but other poor citizens had seen the Tamils sweat to summon solid land from a bog, and that labor had earned a certain deference. 17 years later, almost no one in the slum was considered poor by official Indian benchmarks. Rather, the Annawadians were among roughly 100 million Indians freed from poverty since 1991, when, around the same moment as the small slum's founding, the central government embraced economic liberalization. The Annawadians were thus part of one of the most stirring success narratives in the modern history of global market capitalism, a narrative still unfolding. True, only 6 of the slum's 3,000 residents had permanent jobs. The rest, like 85% of Indian workers, were part of the informal, unorganized economy. True, a few residents trapped rats and frogs and fried them for dinner. A few ate the scrub grass at the sewage lake's edge. And these individuals, miserable souls, thereby made an inestimable contribution to their neighbors. They gave those slum dwellers who didn't fry rats and eat weeds, like Abdul, a felt sense of their upward mobility. The airport and hotels spewed waste in the winter, the peak season for tourism, business travel, and society weddings, whose lack of restraint in 2008 reflected a stock market at an all-time high. Better still for Abdul, a frenzy of Chinese construction in advance of the summer's Beijing Olympics had inflated the price of scrap metal worldwide. It was a fine time to be a Mumbai garbage trader, not that that was the term passerby used for Abdul. Some called him garbage and left it at that. This morning, culling screws and hobnails from his pile, he tried to keep an eye on Annawadi's goats, who liked the smell of the dregs in his bottles and the taste of the paste beneath the labels. Abdul didn't ordinarily mind them nosing around, but these days they were founts of liquid shit, a menace. The goats belonged to a Muslim man who ran a brothel from his hut and considered his whores a pack of malingerers. In an attempt to diversify, he had been raising the animals to sell for sacrifice at Eid, the festival marking the end of Ramadan. The goats had proved as troublesome as the girls, though. 12 of the herd of 22 had died, and the survivors were in intestinal distress. The brothel keeper blamed black magic on the part of the Tamils who ran the local liquor still. Others suspected the goat's drinking source, the sewage lake. Late at night, the contractors modernizing the airport dumped things in the lake. Annawadians also dumped things there, most recently the decomposing carcasses of 12 goats. Whatever was in that soup, the pigs and dogs that slept in its shallows emerged with bellies stained blue. Some creatures survived the lake, though, and not only the malarial mosquitoes. As the morning went on, a fisherman waded through the water, one hand pushing aside cigarette packs and blue plastic bags, the other dimpling the surface with a net. He would take his catch to the Merrill market to be ground into fish oil, a health product for which demand had surged now that it was valued in the West. Rising to shake out a cramp in his calf, Abdul was surprised to find the sky as brown as fly wings, the sun signaling through the haze of pollution the arrival of afternoon. When sorting, he routinely lost track of the hour. His little sisters were playing with the one-leg's daughters on a makeshift wheelchair, a cracked plastic lawn chair flanked by rusted bicycle wheels. Mirchi, already home from ninth grade, was sprawled in the doorway of the family hut, an unread math book on his lap. Mirchi was impatiently awaiting his best friend, Rahul, a Hindu boy who lived a few huts away and who had become an Annawadi celebrity. This month, Rahul had done what Mirchi dreamed of, broken the barrier between the slum world and the rich world. Rahul's mother, Asha, a kindergarten teacher with mysterious connections to local politicians and the police, had managed to secure him several nights of temp work at the Intercontinental Hotel across the sewage lake. Rahul, a pie-faced, snaggle-toothed ninth grader, had seen the Overcity opulence firsthand. And here he came, wearing an ensemble purchased from the profits of this stroke of fortune, cargo shorts that rode low on his hips, a shiny oval belt buckle of promising recyclable weight, a black knit cap pulled down to his eyes.
Hip-hop style, Rahul termed it.
The previous day had been the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, a national holiday on which elite Indians once considered it poor taste to throw a lavish party. But Rahul had worked a manic event at the Intercontinental, and knew Mirchi would appreciate the details.
Mirchi, I cannot lie to you, Rahul said, grinning. On my side of the hall, there were 500 women in only half clothes, like they forgot to put on the bottom half before they left the house.
Where was I? Said Mirchi.
Tell me, anyone famous?
Everyone famous! A Bollywood party! Some of the stars were in the VIP area, behind a rope, but John Abraham came out to near where I was. He had this thick black coat, and he was smoking cigarettes right in front of me. And Vipasha was supposedly there, but I couldn't be sure it was really her or just some other item girl, because if the manager sees you looking at the guests, he'll fire you. Take your whole pay. They told us that 20 times before the party started, like we were weak in the head. You have to focus on the tables and the rug. Then, when you see a dirty plate or a napkin, you have to snatch it and take it to the trash bin in the back.
Oh, that room was looking nice.
First, we laid this thick white carpet. You stepped on it and sank right down. Then they lit white candles and made it dark like a disco. And on this one table, the chef put two huge dolphins made out of flavored ice. One dolphin had cherries for eyes. Bastard, forget the fish. Tell me about the girls,
Mirchi protested.
They want you to look when they dress like that.
Seriously, you can't look.
Not even at the rich people's toilets. Security will chuck you out. The toilets for the workers were nice, though. You have a choice between Indian or American style.
Rahul, who had a patriotic streak, had peed in the Indian one, an open drain in the floor. Other boys joined Rahul outside the Hussein's hut. Anawadians liked to talk about the hotels and the depraved things that likely went on inside. One drug-addled scavenger talked to the hotels.
I know you're trying to kill me, you sister fucking Hyatt!
But Rahul's accounts had special value, since he didn't lie, or at least not more than one sentence out of 20. This, along with a cheerful disposition, made him a boy whose privileges other boys did not resent. Rahul gamely conceded he was a nothing compared with the Intercontinental's regular workers. Many of the waiters were college-educated, tall and light-skinned, with cell phones so shiny their owners could fix their hair in the reflections. Some of the waiters had mocked Rahul's long, blue-painted thumbnail, which was high masculine style at Anawadi. When he cut the nail off, they teased him about how he talked. The Anawadian's deferential term for a rich man, Saab, was not the proper term in the city's moneyed quarters, he reported to his friends.
The waiters say it makes you sound D-class, like a thug, a tapori. He said, the right word is sir.
Sir,
someone said, rolling the R's. Then everyone started saying it, laughing. The boys stood close together, though there was plenty of space in the Maidan. For people who slept in close quarters, his foot in my mouth, my foot in hers, the feel of skin against skin got to be a habit. Abdul stepped around them, upending an armful of torn paper luggage tags on the Maidan and scrambling after the tags that blew away. The other boys paid him no notice. Abdul didn't talk much, and when he did, it was as if he'd spent weeks privately working over some little idea. He might have had a friend or two if he'd known how to tell a good story. Once, working on this shortcoming, he'd floated a tale about having been inside the Intercontinental himself, how a Bollywood movie called Welcome had been filming there, and how he'd seen Katrina Kaif dressed all in white. It had been a feeble fiction. Rahul had seen through it immediately. but Rahul's latest report would allow Abdul's future lies to be better informed. A Nepali boy asked Rahul about the women in the hotels. Through slats in the hotel fences, he had seen some of them smoking.
Not one cigarette, but many.
While they waited for their drivers to pull up to the entrance.
Which village do they come from, these women?
Listen, idiot, Rahul said affectionately. The white people come from all different countries. You're a real hick if you don't know this basic thing.
Which countries? America?
Rahul couldn't say.
But there are so many Indian guests in the hotels too, I guarantee you.
Indians who were healthy-sized, big and fat, as opposed to stunted, like the Nepali boy and many other children here. Rahul's first job had been the Intercontinental's New Year's Eve party. The New Year's bashes at Mumbai's luxury hotels were renowned, and scavengers had often returned to Anawadi bearing discarded brochures.
Celebrate 2008 in high style at Le Royal Meridian Hotel. Take a stroll down the streets of Paris, splurging with art, music, and food. Get scintillated with live performances. Book your boarding passes and bon voyage, 12,000 rupees per couple with champagne.
The advertisements were printed on glossy paper, for which recyclers paid 2 rupees, or 4 US cents, per kilo. Rahul had been underwhelmed by the New Year's rituals of the rich. Moronic, he had concluded.
Just people drinking and dancing and standing around acting stupid, like people here do every night.
The hotel people get strange when they drink, he told his friends. Last night at the end of the party, there was one hero, good-looking, stripes on his suit, expensive cloth. He was drunk, full tight, and he started stuffing bread into his pants pockets, jacket pockets. Then he put more rolls straight into his pants. Rolls fell on the floor, and he was crawling under the table to get them. This one waiter was saying the guy must have been hungry earlier. That whiskey brought back the memory. But when I get rich enough to be a guest at a big hotel, I'm not going to act like such a loser.
Mirchi laughed and asked the question that many were asking of themselves in Mumbai in 2008.
And what are you going to do, sir, so that you get served at such a hotel?
But Rahul was shoving off, his attention diverted to a green plastic kite snagged high in a peepal tree at Anawadi's entrance. It appeared to be broken, but once the bones were pressed straight, he figured he could resell it for 2 rupees. He just needed to claim the kite before the idea occurred to some other money-minded boy. Rahul had learned his serial entrepreneurship from his mother, Asha, a woman who scared Abdul's parents a little. She was a stalwart in a political party, Shiv Sena, which was dominated by Hindus born in Maharashtra, Mumbai's home state. As the population of Greater Mumbai pressed toward 20 million, competition for jobs and housing was ferocious, and Shiv Sena blamed migrants from other states for taking opportunities that rightfully belonged to the natives. The party's octogenarian founder, Bal Thackeray, retained a fondness for Hitler's program of ethnic cleansing. Shiv Sena's current galvanizing cause was expelling migrants from India's poor northern states. Its animus toward the city's Muslim minority was of longer, more violent standing. That made Abdul's family, Muslims with roots in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, twice suspect. The friendship of Rahul and Mirchi transcended ethnic and religious politics, though. Mirchi sometimes raised his fist and yelled the Shiv Sena greeting,
Jai Maharashtra!
Just to make Rahul laugh. The 2 ninth graders had even started to look alike, having decided to let their bangs grow into long floppy forelocks, which they brushed out of their eyes like the film hero Ajay Devgan. Abdul envied their closeness. His only sort of friend was a homeless 15-year-old boy named Kallu, who robbed recycling bins in airport compounds. But Kallu worked nights when Abdul slept, and they didn't talk much anymore. Abdul's deepest affection was for his 2-year-old brother, Lalu, a fact that had begun to concern him. Listening to Bollywood love songs, he could only conclude that his own heart had been made too small. He'd never longed with extravagance for a girl, and while he felt certain he loved his mother, the feeling didn't come in any big gush. But he could get tearful just looking at Lalu, who was as fearless as Abdul was flinchy. all those swollen rat bites on his cheeks, on the back of his head. What to do? When the storeroom grew too crowded, as it did in flush months like this one, garbage piled up in their hut, and rats came too. But when Abdul left garbage outside, it got stolen by the scavengers, and he hated to buy the same garbage twice. By 3 p.m., Abdul was facing down the bottle caps, a major sorting nuisance. Some had plastic interior linings, which had to be stripped out before the caps could be assigned to the aluminum pile. Rich people's garbage was every year more complex, rife with hybrid materials, impurities, imposters. Planks that looked like wood were shot through with plastic. How was he to classify a loofah? The owners of the recycling plants demanded waste that was all one thing, pure. His mother was squatting beside him, applying a stone to a heap of wet, dirty clothes. She glared at Mirchi, drowsing in the doorway.
"What? School holiday?" she said.
Zerunisa expected Mirchi to pass ninth grade at the third-rate Urdu language private school for which they paid 300 rupees a year. They'd had to pay, since spreading educational opportunity was not among the Indian government's strong suits. The free municipal school near the airport stopped at eighth grade, and its teachers often didn't show up.
"Either study or help your brother," Zerunisa said to Mirchi.
He glanced at Abdul's recyclables and opened his math book. Recently, even looking at garbage made Mirchi depressed, a development that Abdul had willed himself not to resent. Instead, he tried to share his parents' hope that when his brother finished high school, his considerable wit and charm would trump the job market liability of being a Muslim. Although Mumbai was said to be more cosmopolitan and meritocratic than any other Indian city, Muslims were still excluded from many good jobs, including some in the luxury hotels where Mirchi longed to work. It made sense to Abdul that in a polyglot city, people would sort themselves as he sorted his garbage, like with like. There were too many people in Mumbai for everyone to have a job, so why wouldn't Kunbi caste Hindus from Maharashtra hire other Kunbis from Maharashtra, instead of hiring a Muslim of garbage-related provenance? But Mirchi said that everyone was mixing up nowadays, that old prejudices were losing strength, and that Abdul just couldn't see it, spending his days with his head in his trash pile. Abdul was now working as fast as he could in order to finish by dusk, when strapping Hindu boys began playing cricket on the Maidan, aiming their drives at his sordid piles and sometimes his head. While the cricketers sorely tested Abdul's policy of non-confrontation, the only physical fight he'd ever had was with 2 10-year-olds who had turf-stomped one of his little brothers. And these cricketers had just sent another Muslim kid to the hospital, after smashing his head in with their bats. High above Abdul, Rahul was bobbling on another tree branch, trying to liberate a second resalable kite. The leaves of the tree were gray, like many things in Anawadi, on account of sand and gravel blowing in from a concrete plant nearby. "You won't die to breathe it," old-timers assured red-eyed new arrivals who fretted about the spoon-it-up air. But people seemed to die of it all the time. Untreated asthma, lung obstructions, tuberculosis. Abdul's father, hacking away in their hut, spoke of the truer consolation. The concrete plant and all the other construction brought more work to this airport boomtown. Bad lungs were a toll you paid to live near progress. At 6 p.m., Abdul stood up, triumphant. He'd beaten the cricketers, and before him were 14 lumpy sacks of sordid waste. As smoke clouds rose from the surrounding hotels, their evening fumigation against mosquitoes, Abdul and two of his little brothers hauled the sacks to the truck bed of a lime-green three-wheeled jalopy. This small vehicle, one of the Hussein's most important possessions, allowed Abdul to deliver the waste to the recyclers. And now, out onto Airport Road and into the city's horn-honk opera. Four-wheelers, bikes, buses, scooters, thousands of people on foot. It took Abdul more than an hour to go 3 miles, given calamitous traffic at an intersection by the gardens of the Hotel Lila, around the corner of which European sedans awaited servicing at a concern named Spa Dakar. A section of the city's first metro rail was being constructed here, to complement an elevated expressway slowly rising on Airport Road. Abdul feared running out of gas while in the gridlock, but in the last spidery light before nightfall, his wheezing vehicle gained a vast slum